Hello, welcome to Science TLDR.
Hello. Today we're diving into a really interesting question. Did a major shift in advice about feeding babies actually work out here in the real world?
We're looking at the paper Guidelines for Early Food Introduction and Patterns of Food Allergy, which was published in Pediatrics.
And the focus is on immunoglobulin-mediated food allergy, IgEFA. It's a significant public health concern.
Definitely. It's the biggest trigger for severe allergic reactions, anaphylaxis in kids. And something like peanut allergy often sticks around for life. Big impact on quality of life, costs, everything.
Yeah, the stakes for preventing it are incredibly high. And for a long time, the advice was, well, delay giving kids foods like peanuts.
Right, delay the common allergens. But that got officially withdrawn back in 2008 because, frankly, it just wasn't preventing allergies.
Exactly. Then came the big turning point in 2015, the LAP trial, learning early about peanut allergy.
Oh, yeah. LAP was huge. What did it find again?
It showed the babies between 4 and 11 months old who regularly ate peanut products actually had an 81% lower risk of developing peanut allergy by the time they were 5.
An 81% reduction. That's massive. And that finding pretty much directly led to new guidelines in 2015 from multiple organizations, right?
It did. And then there was an addendum kind of reinforcement in 2017.
So the core question this pediatrics paper tackled is, did telling everyone to do the opposite of what they'd been doing for years to introduce peanut early actually change the rates of peanut allergy or any food allergy across the U.S., did the guidelines work in practice?
Precisely. Did the policy shift translate into real-world results?
Okay, so how did they try to answer that? You'd need a lot of data.
They used a fantastic resource, the CER2 Network. That's the American Academy of Pediatrics Comparative Effectiveness Research through Collaborative Electronic Reporting Network.
Okay, CER2. So that's basically anonymized electronic health record data, EHR data.
Exactly. From lots of primary care pediatric practices across different states, a huge pool of real-world information.
And they use this data to compare different time periods.
Right. They set up 3 cohorts of kids aged 0 to 3 years based on when they kind of entered the system. There was a pre-guidelines group starting 2012 to 2014.
Before the big shift.
Then a post-guidelines group, 2015 to 2017, right after LA and the first guidelines.
Okay.
And finally, a post-addendum group, starting 2017 to 2019, after the updated advice came out.
That structure makes sense. It lets you see if things changed right after 2015, and then if they changed again after 2017.
Yeah, it maps the potential impact over time as the guidelines rolled out and got more established.
All right, let's get into the results. But first, a really important point with EHR data. How did they define a food allergy? How did they make sure it was a real diagnosed IgEFA and not just, you know, a note in the chart saying mom thinks made peanuts?
That's crucial. They used a very strict 3-part definition, which really boosts confidence in the findings.
Okay, what were the 3 parts?
So first, the child needed the right diagnosis code, an ICD or SNOM-MD code for food allergy. Second, there had to be at least 1 specific food allergy documented in the actual allergy section of the EHR.
Makes sense.
And the third?
And this is, they had to have a prescription for an epinephrine auto-injector, an EpiPen or similar device.
Ah, okay. So that filters it down to kids whose allergy was considered serious enough by a clinician to warrant having emergency treatment on hand.
Exactly. It weeds out less certain or milder cases and focuses on clinically significant IgEFA.
Got it. So using that robust definition, what did they find when comparing the pre-guidelines group to the first post-guidelines group?
A really significant drop. For peanut IgEFA, the cumulative incidence, basically the rate of new diagnoses over 2 years, fell from 0.92% down to 0.67%.
Okay, 0.92 down to 0.67%. That's a reduction of, what, about 27%?
Yeah, 27.2%. And for having any IgEFA, 1 or more food allergies, the drop is even bigger, from 1.98% down to 1.23%.
Wow, that's nearly a 38% decrease in any diagnosed food allergy.
37.9%, yeah. Pretty substantial changes.
But hang on, that 27% reduction for peanut allergy, it's good, obviously, a definite win. But the LAP trial showed an 81% reduction.
Ah, yes. The gap between the clinical trial efficacy and the real-world effectiveness. That's a central theme here. We'll definitely come back to why that gap might exist.
Okay, but first, how do they express this change in risk over time?
They used hazard ratios, HRs. An HR basically tells you the risk of something happening in one group compared to another over the observation period.
Right. So an HR less than 1 means lower risk in the post-guidelines group.
Exactly. And for peanut IgEFA, the HR was 0.65 comparing post-guidelines to pre-guidelines. For any IgEFA, it was 0.69.
So roughly a 31 to 35% lower hazard or risk of being diagnosed in that post-guideline period. That's significant.
Definitely statistically significant, yes.
And did things improve even more after the 2017 addendum guidelines came out?
They did. When they compared the pre-guidelines cohort to the later post-addendum cohort, looking at diagnoses within the first year, the peanut IgE FA incidence dropped even further, down to 0.45%.
Wow. Okay. So compared to the baseline before 2015, what kind of total reduction is that?
That works out to a 43% decrease from the pre-guideline rate.
And the hazard ratio for that comparison?
The HR for peanut IgE FA dropped to 0.55 for the post-addendum group versus the pre-guidelines group.
So nearly cutting the risk in half compared to before the guidelines started rolling out. That shows continued progress.
It does suggest that reinforcing the message and perhaps refining the guidance had an additional positive effect.
And they were confident this drop was actually because of the guidelines, not just some background trend.
Yes. They used a technique called interrupted time series analysis. It's specifically designed for this kind of policy change evaluation.
How does that work, briefly?
It looks at the trend in diagnosis rates before the guidelines hit, and then looks for a significant change in that trend, like a change in the slope, right after the intervention.
And they found one.
They did. They found a significant downward shift in the rate of diagnosing one or more IgE FAs after the guidelines. It strongly suggests the guidelines themselves were the driver.
Okay, that's compelling evidence for the overall impact. Let's dig into some of the details now. What about different groups of kids? LEP focused a lot on high-risk kids, especially those with eczema or atopic dermatitis, AD. Did the benefit mostly go to them?
That's a really interesting finding here. The paper found that the decrease in both peanut and any IgE FA was statistically significant whether or not the child had a prior diagnosis of atopic dermatitis.
Oh, that's important clinically, isn't it?
Hugely important. Mm. It really supports the recent shift away from needing strict risk stratification before starting early introduction. The message seems to be early introduction helps broadly, not just in those pre-identified high-risk cases.
So you don't necessarily need to wait for an eczema diagnosis to start thinking about early introduction.
Exactly. The benefit seems to apply more widely.
But didn't the paper also find something odd happening with AD diagnoses themselves?
Yes, this was fascinating. At the same time that IgE FA rates were dropping, the rate of diagnosing atopic dermatitis actually went up significantly.
Up? How does that fit? More AD should mean more risk for food allergies, shouldn't it?
Well, the authors suggest this might reflect better and earlier recognition of AD by doctors in primary care.
Ah, so doctors got better at spotting eczema.
And because AD is such a well-known risk factor for food allergy, maybe identifying it earlier spurred them to be more proactive about recommending early food introduction for those kids.
So improved AD diagnosis might have actually contributed to the decrease in food allergies by triggering the intervention earlier.
That's the hypothesis. It points to a complex interplay between clinical practice changes like documentation and recognition and the actual biological changes in disease rates.
Interesting. Okay, what about other food allergies beyond peanut? Did early introduction tackle things like milk or egg allergy too?
The picture there is a bit more mixed. They definitely saw a shift in which allergies were most common.
How so?
In the later periods, after the guidelines, egg allergy actually overtook peanut allergy as the most frequently documented IgE FA in this cohort.
Egg became number one. What about milk?
Cow's milk, IgE FA, did decrease significantly. So success there, similar to peanut.
But egg didn't decrease, even though it became the most common.
Correct. The incidence of egg allergy didn't show a statistically significant decrease. It stayed pretty steady.
Hmm. Any thoughts on why peanut and milk allergies dropped, but egg didn't seem to budge as much, despite the guidelines?
It's hard to say for sure from this data. Maybe the guidance for egg introduction is trickier to implement in the real world.
Yeah.
You know, preparing cooked egg yolk consistently versus using a peanut puff.
Yeah, or maybe the required frequency or dose for protection is different for egg and parents weren't quite hitting it.
Could be. It really highlights that real-world implementation isn't uniform across all allergens. There's variability in how effectively the guidance is being applied, or perhaps how effective it is for different foods outside a controlled trial.
Okay, one last piece from the results. Demographics. Did the types of children being diagnosed with IgE FA change over time?
Yes, there were some notable shifts. In the post-guidelines periods, the kids who were diagnosed with IgE FA were more likely to be very young, 0 to 4 months old, and more likely to be white.
And conversely,
there was a decrease in the proportion of diagnosed kids who were Black, Asian or Pacific Islander, or Hispanic.
What did the authors make of that?
They're cautious. They note it could reflect differences in access to care, like getting in to see a specialist early, or maybe differences in feeding practices between groups.
Or limitations of the data set itself.
Right. They point out the CER2 cohort isn't perfectly nationally representative. It had a higher proportion of Black children and a lower proportion of Hispanic children than the U.S. Census. So these demographic shifts need careful interpretation.
Understood. Let's zoom out a bit. How does this U.S. study fit with what's been seen internationally with similar guideline changes?
It's a valuable piece of the puzzle. Some places, like parts of Canada and Australia, did see drops in anaphylaxis rates, which is a severe outcome. But other studies, maybe using different methods like surveys or cross-sectional checks, found smaller effects or no significant change in overall prevalence.
So the evidence globally has been a bit mixed.
A bit mixed, yes. This study, because it uses EHR data linked to that specific clinical diagnosis plus the EpiPen prescription, provides pretty strong evidence for a reduction in diagnosed managed IgE-FA here in the U.S.
Okay, but let's circle back to that gap we mentioned, the LEAP trial. 81% reduction, this study's best estimate for peanut, 45% reduction. That's a big difference.
It absolutely is. And that difference between the controlled trial and the real-world data is probably the biggest takeaway regarding implementation.
What does it tell us?
It strongly suggests there's still, well, an opportunity to strengthen implementation, as the paper puts it. The guidelines work, but maybe they aren't being followed consistently or effectively enough in the real world to achieve that maximum potential benefit seen in LE.
And the study couldn't tell us why that gap exists, right? Because it's EHR data.
Exactly. That's a key limitation.
Yeah.
They don't know the actual feeding patterns. When parents introduced foods, how often they gave them, how much they gave. We know from LEAP that consistent, sustained ingestion was important.
So maybe parents are trying early introduction, but not quite frequently enough, or maybe they stop too soon, or maybe they're anxious about it. Lots of possibilities.
All possibilities. And that variability in real-world adherence is likely why we see a 45% reduction instead of 81%. There are barriers, maybe caregiver anxiety, practical difficulties, cost, conflicting advice that prevent achieving the full effect.
So the guidelines clearly had a positive impact, reducing diagnoses significantly, but there's still work to do to help families implement them optimally.
Precisely. Future research really needs to get into the weeds of which specific feeding practices, the timing, frequency, dose, give the best protection in a typical primary care population, not just a trial setting.
And we need to keep tracking these allergy rates over time.
Absolutely. Ongoing monitoring is critical to see if these trends continue or change.
Okay, this has been a fascinating look at how a major piece of clinical evidence translated into policy and then into real-world outcomes. Let's try to boil it down. What are the three major takeaways you'd want our listeners to get from the results section of this paper?
Okay, three key results. First, the risk of being diagnosed with peanut IgEEF and also any IgEFA went down significantly after the early introduction guidelines were published. The hazard ratio for peanut allergy dropped to 0.55 by the post-addendum period, meaning about a 45% lower risk compared to before the guidelines.
Right. Guideline implementation led to a measurable drop in diagnoses. Takeaway number two.
Second, the landscape of common food allergies shifted. Egg allergy became the most commonly documented one in this group, overtaking peanut. And while milk allergy also decreased significantly, egg allergy rates didn't really change much. So the success wasn't uniform across all foods.
Okay, a shift in the hierarchy and variable success by food type. And the third takeaway.
Third, at the same time food allergies were decreasing, diagnoses of atopic dermatitis eczema were significantly increasing. This hints that better, earlier recognition of AD by doctors might be playing a role in driving prevention efforts, even though the allergy reduction was seen regardless of an AD diagnosis in the records.
A complex picture indeed. Improved clinical practice potentially boosting the impact of the intervention itself.
Seems likely, yeah.
So as a final thought for you, the listener, consider this. How do we untangle the effects of changing clinical documentation, like doctors getting better at recording eczema from the true underlying biological changes in how common a disease is, especially after a big public health push like this?
That EHR data gives us a powerful lens, but interpreting exactly what's driving every change, whether it's behavior, biology, or just better record keeping, that remains a really interesting challenge.
Something to definitely chew on.